she wondered why, knowing that even a month before she could never have done the deed. Pretty young Mrs. Hamilton, with her dimple and her jingling earbobs and her helpless little ways, blowing a man's face to a pulp and then burying him in a hastily scratched-out hole. Scarlet grinned a little grimly, thinking of the consternation such an idea would bring to those who knew her. "I won't think about it any more," she decided. "It's over and done with. And I'd have been a ninny not to kill him. I reckon I must have changed a little since coming home, or else I couldn't have done it." She did not think of it consciously. But in the back of her mind, whenever she was confronted by an unpleasant and difficult task, the idea lurked, giving her strength. "I've done murder, and so I can surely do this." She had changed more than she knew. And the shell of hardness which had begun to form about her heart when she lay in the slave garden at Twelve Oaks was slowly thickening. Now that she had a horse, Scarlet could find out for herself what had happened to her neighbors. Since she came home, she had wondered despairingly 1,000 times, "Are we the only folks left in the county? Has everybody else been burned out? Have they all refugeed to Macon?" With the memory of the ruins of Twelve Oaks, the McIntosh place, and the Slattery shack fresh in her mind, she almost dreaded to discover the truth. But it was better to know the worst than to wonder. She decided to ride to the Fontaines first, not because they were the nearest neighbors, but because old Dr. Fontaine might be there. Melanie needed a doctor. She wasn't recovering as she should, and Scarlet was frightened by her white weakness. So on the first day, when her foot had healed enough to stand a slipper, she mounted the Yankee's horse. One foot in the shortened stirrup, and the other leg crooked about the pommel in an approximation of a side saddle, she set out across the fields toward Mimosa, steeling herself to find it burned. To her surprise and pleasure, she saw the faded yellow stucco house standing amid the mimosa trees, looking as it had always looked. Warm happiness, happiness that almost brought tears, flooded her when the three Fontaine women came out of the house to welcome her with kisses and cries of joy. But when the first exclamations of affectionate greeting were over, and they had all trooped into the dining room to sit down, Scarlet felt a chill. The Yankees hadn't reached Mimosa because it was far off the main road. And so the Fontaines still had their stock and their provisions. But Mimosa was held by the same strange silence that hung over Terra, over the whole countryside. All the slaves, except 4 women house servants, had run away, frightened by the approach of the Yankees. There was not a man on the place, unless Sally's little boy Joe, hardly out of diapers, could be counted as a man. Alone in the big house were Grandma Fontaine, in her 70s, her daughter-in-law, who would always be known as Young Miss, though she was in her 50s, and Sally, who had barely turned 20. They were far away from neighbors and unprotected, but if they were afraid, it didn't show on their faces. Probably, thought Scarlet, because Sally and Young Miss were too afraid of the porcelain frail but indomitable old grandma to dare voice any qualms. Scarlet herself was afraid of the old lady, for she had sharp eyes and a sharper tongue, and Scarlet had felt them both in the past. Though unrelated by blood and far apart in age, there was a kinship of spirit and experience binding these women together. All 3 wore home-dyed mourning. All were worn, sad, worried. All bitter with a bitterness that did not sulk or complain, but nevertheless peered out from behind their smiles and their words of welcome. For their slaves were gone. Their money was worthless. Sally's husband, Joe, had died at Gettysburg, and Young Miss was also a widow. For young Dr. Fontaine had died of dysentery at Vicksburg. The other 2 boys, Alex and Tony, were somewhere in Virginia, and nobody knew whether they were alive or dead. And old Dr. Fontaine was off somewhere with Wheeler's cavalry. And the old fool is 73 years old, though he tries to act younger, and he's as full of rheumatism as a hog is of fleas, said Grandma, proud of her husband, the light in her eyes belying her sharp words. "Have you all had any news of what's been happening in Atlanta?" asked Scarlett, when they were comfortably settled. "We are completely buried at Terra." "Law, child," said old Miss, taking charge of the conversation, as was her habit. "We're in the same fix as you are. We don't know a thing except that Sherman finally got the town."
"So he did get it. What's he doing now? Where's the fighting now?"
"And how would three lone women out here in the country know about the war when we haven't seen a letter or a newspaper in weeks?" said the old lady tartly. "One of our darkies talked to a darkie who'd seen a darkie who'd been to Jonesboro, and except for that, we haven't heard anything. What they said was that the Yankees were just squatting in Atlanta resting up their men and their horses, but whether it's true or not, you're as good a judge as I am. Not that they wouldn't need a rest after the fight we gave them."
"To think you've been at Terra all this time and we didn't know," young Miss broke in. "Oh, how I blame myself for not riding over to see. But there's been so much to do here, with most all the darkies gone, that I just couldn't get away. But I should have made time to go. It wasn't neighborly of me. But, of course, we thought the Yankees had burned Terra like they did 12 Oaks and the McIntosh house, and that your folks had gone to Macon. And we never dreamed you were home, Scarlett."
"Well, how were we to know different when Mr. O'Hara's darkies came through here so scared they were pop-eyed and told us the Yankees were going to burn Terra?" Grandma interrupted.
"And we could see," Sally began.
"I'm telling this, please," said old Miss shortly. "And they said the Yankees were camped all over Terra, and your folks were fixing to go to Macon. And then that night we saw the glare of fire over toward Terra, and it lasted for hours, and it scared our fool darkies so bad they all ran off." "What burned?"
"All our cotton. $150,000 worth," said Scarlett bitterly.
"Be thankful it wasn't your house," said Grandma, leaning her chin on her cane. "You can always grow more cotton, and you can't grow a house. By the by, had you all started picking your cotton?"
"No," said Scarlett. "And now most of it is ruined. I don't imagine there's more than 3 bales left standing in the far field in the creek bottom. And what earthly good will it do? All our field hands are gone, and there's nobody to pick it."
"Mercy me! All our field hands are gone, and there's nobody to pick it," mimicked Grandma, and bent a satiric glance on Scarlett. "What's wrong with your own pretty paws, miss, and those of your sisters?"
"Me? Pick cotton?" cried Scarlett, aghast, as if Grandma had been suggesting some repulsive crime. "Like a field hand? Like white trash? Like the Slattery women?"
"White trash, indeed. Well, isn't this generation soft and ladylike? Let me tell you, miss, when I was a girl, my father lost all his money, and I wasn't above doing honest work with my hands, and in the fields, too, till Pa got enough money to buy some more darkies. I've hoed my row, and I've picked my cotton, and I can do it again if I have to. And it looks like I'll have to. White trash, indeed."
"Oh, but Mama Fontaine," cried her daughter-in-law, casting imploring glances at the two girls, urging them to help her smooth the old lady's feathers. "That was so long ago, a different day entirely, and times have changed."
"Times never change when there's a need for honest work to be done," stated the sharp-eyed old lady, refusing to be soothed. "And I'm ashamed for your mother, Scarlett, to hear you stand there and talk as though honest work made white trash out of nice people. When Adam delved and Eve span—"
To change the subject, Scarlett hastily questioned, "What about the Tarltons and the Calverts? Were they burned out? Have they refugeed to Macon?" The Yankees never got to the Tarltons. They're off the main road like we are. But they did get to the Calverts, and they stole all their stock and poultry and got all the darkies to run off with them. Sally began. Grandma interrupted. Ha! They promised all the black winches silk dresses and gold earbobs. That's what they did. And Kathleen Calvert said some of the troopers went off with the black fools behind them on their saddles. Well, all they'll get will be yellow babies, and I can't say that Yankee blood will improve the stock. Oh, Mama Fontaine! Don't pull such a shocked face, Jane. We're all married, aren't we? And God knows we've seen mulatto babies before this.
Why didn't they burn the Calvert's house?
The house was saved by the combined accents of the second Mrs. Calvert and that Yankee overseer of hers, Hilton.
Said old miss, who always referred to the ex-governess as the second Mrs. Calvert, although the first Mrs. Calvert had been dead 20 years.
"We are staunch Union sympathizers," mimicked the old lady, twanging the words through her long, thin nose. Kathleen said the two of them swore up hill and down dale that the whole parcel of Calverts were Yankees. And Mr. Calvert dead in the wilderness. And Rayford at Gettysburg and Cade in Virginia with the army. Kathleen was so mortified, she said she'd rather the house had been burned. She said Cade would bust when he came home and heard about it. But then, that's what a man gets for marrying a Yankee woman. No pride, no decency, always thinking about their own skins.
How come they didn't burn Tara, Scarlet? For a moment, Scarlet paused before answering. She knew the very next question would be, "And how are all your folks? And how is your dear mother?" She knew she couldn't tell them Ellen was dead. She knew that if she spoke those words, or even let herself think of them in the presence of these sympathetic women, she would burst into a storm of tears and cry until she was sick. And she could not let herself cry. She had not really cried since she came home, and she knew that if she once let down the floodgates, her closely husbanded courage would all be gone. But she knew, too, looking with confusion at the friendly faces about her, that if she withheld the news of Ellen's death, the Fontaines would never forgive her. Grandma, in particular, was devoted to Ellen, and there were very few people in the county for whom the old lady gave a snap of her skinny fingers.
"Well, speak up," said Grandma, looking sharply at her. "Don't you know, miss?"
"Well, you see, I didn't get home till the day after the battle," she answered hastily. "The Yankees were all gone then. Pa told me that he got them not to burn the house because Sue Ellen and Corinne were so ill with typhoid they couldn't be moved."
"That's the first time I ever heard of a Yankee doing a decent thing," said Grandma, as if she regretted hearing anything good about the invaders. "And how are the girls now?"
"Oh, they are much better, much better. Almost well, but quite weak," answered Scarlet. Then, seeing the question she feared hovering on the old lady's lips, she cast hastily about for some other topic of conversation.
I wonder if you could lend us something to eat. The Yankees cleaned us out like a swarm of locusts. But if you are short on rations, just tell me so plainly, and—"
"Send over pork with a wagon, and you shall have half of what we've got. Rice, meal, ham, some chickens," said old miss, giving Scarlet a sudden keen look.
"Oh, that's too much, really.
Not a word. I won't hear it. What are neighbors for?"
"You are so kind that I can't—" "But I have to be going now. The folks at home will be worrying about me."
Grandma rose abruptly and took Scarlet by the arm.
"You two stay here,"
she commanded, pushing Scarlet toward the back porch.
"I have a private word for this child. Help me down the steps, Scarlet."
Young Miss and Sally said goodbye and promised to come calling soon. They were devoured by curiosity as to what Grandma had to say to Scarlet, but unless she chose to tell them, they would never know.
"Old ladies were so difficult," young miss whispered to Sally as they went back to their sewing.
Scarlet stood with her hand on the horse's bridle, a dull feeling at her heart.
"Now," said Grandma, peering into her face, "what's wrong at Terra? What are you keeping back?"
Scarlet looked up into the keen old eyes and knew she could tell the truth without tears. No one could cry in the presence of Grandma Fontaine without her express permission.
"Mother is dead," she said flatly.
The hand on her arm tightened until it pinched, and the wrinkled lids over the yellow eyes blinked.
"Did the Yankees kill her?"
"She died of typhoid. Died the day before I came home."
"Don't think about it,"
said Grandma sternly, and Scarlet saw her swallow.
"And your pa?"
Pa is not himself."
"What do you mean? Speak up. Is he ill?"
"The shock. He is so strange. He is not..."
"Don't tell me he's not himself. Do you mean his mind is unhinged?"
It was a relief to hear the truth put so boldly. How good the old lady was to offer no sympathy that would make her cry.
"Yes," she said dully.
"He's lost his mind. He acts dazed, and sometimes he can't seem to remember that Mother is dead." "Oh, old miss, it's more than I can stand to see him sit by the hour waiting for her, and so patiently, too. And he used to have no more patience than a child. But it's worse when he does remember that she's gone. Every now and then, after he's sat still with his ear cocked, listening for her, he jumps up suddenly and stumps out of the house and down to the burying ground. And then he comes dragging back with the tears all over his face, and he says over and over till I can scream, 'Katie Scarlet, Mrs. O'Hara is dead. Your mother is dead.' And it's just like I was hearing it again for the first time. And sometimes, late at night, I hear him calling her, and I get out of bed and go to him and tell him she's down at the quarters with a sick darky. And he fusses because she's always tiring herself out nursing people. And it's so hard to get him back to bed. He's like a child. Oh, I wish Dr. Fontaine was here. I know he could do something for Pa. And Melanie needs a doctor, too. She isn't getting over her baby like she should."
"Melly? A baby? And she's with you?"
"Yes."
"What's Melly doing with you? Why isn't she in Macon with her aunt and her kinfolks?" "I never thought you liked her any too well, miss, for all she was Charles's sister." "Now tell me all about it."
"It's a long story, old miss. Don't you want to go back in the house and sit down?"
"I can stand," said Grandma shortly. "And if you told your story in front of the others, they'd be bawling and making you feel sorry for yourself. Now let's have it."
Scarlet began haltingly, with the siege and Melanie's condition. But as her story progressed, beneath the sharp old eyes which never faltered in their gaze, she found words. Words of power and horror. It all came back to her. The sickeningly hot day of the baby's birth. The agony of fear. The flight and Rhett's desertion. She spoke of the wild darkness of the night, the blazing campfires which might be friends or foes, the gaunt chimneys which met her gaze in the morning sun, the dead men and horses along the road, the hunger, the desolation, the fear that Terra had been burned. "I thought if I could just get home to Mother, she could manage everything and I could lay down the weary load. On the way home, I thought the worst had already happened to me. But when I knew she was dead, I knew what the worst really was." She dropped her eyes to the ground and waited for Grandma to speak. The silence was so prolonged, she wondered if Grandma could have failed to comprehend her desperate plight. Finally, the old voice spoke, and her tones were kind, kinder than Scarlet had ever heard her use in addressing anyone.
"Child,
It's a very bad thing for a woman to face the worst that can happen to her. Because after she's faced the worst, she can't ever really fear anything again. And it's very bad for a woman not to be afraid of something. You think I don't understand what you've told me, what you've been through? Well, I understand very well. When I was about your age, I was in the Creek Uprising, right after the Fort Mims massacre.
Yes?
She said in a faraway voice. Just about your age, for that was 50-odd years ago. And I managed to get into the bushes and hide, and I lay there, and saw our house burn. And I saw the Indians scalp my brothers and sisters. And I could only lie there and pray that the light of the flames wouldn't show up my hiding place. And they dragged Mother out and killed her about 20 feet from where I was lying. And scalped her, too. And ever so often one Indian would go back to her and sink his tomahawk into her skull again. I was my mother's pet, and I lay there and saw it all. And in the morning, I set out for the nearest settlement, and it was 30 miles away. It took me 3 days to get there, through the swamps and the Indians, and afterward they thought I'd lose my mind. That's where I met Dr. Fontaine. He looked after me. Ah, well, that's been 50 years ago, as I said. And since that time, I've never been afraid of anything or anybody because I'd known the worst that could happen to me. And that lack of fear has gotten me into a lot of trouble and cost me a lot of happiness. God intended women to be timid, frightened creatures. And there's something unnatural about a woman who isn't afraid. Scarlet always saves something to fear. Even as you save something to love. Her voice trailed off, and she stood silent, with eyes looking back over half a century to the day when she had been afraid. Scarlet moved impatiently. She had thought Grandma was going to understand and perhaps show her some way to solve her problems. But like all old people, she'd gotten to talking about things that happened before anyone was born. Things no one was interested in. Scarlet wished she had not confided in her. "Well, go home, child, or they'll be worrying about you," she said suddenly. "Send pork with the wagon this afternoon. And don't think you can lay down the load ever. Because you can't. I know." Indian summer lingered into November that year, and the warm days were bright days for those at Tara. The worst was over. They had a horse now, and they could ride instead of walk. They had fried eggs for breakfast and fried ham for supper to vary the monotony of the yams, peanuts, and dried apples. And on one festal occasion, they even had roast chicken. The old sow had finally been captured, and she and her brood rooted and grunted happily under the house where they were penned. Sometimes they squealed so loudly no one in the house could talk, but it was a pleasant sound. It meant fresh pork for the white folks, and chitlins for the Negroes when cold weather and hog-killing time should arrive. And it meant food for the winter for all. Scarlet's visit to the Fontaines had heartened her more than she realized. Just the knowledge that she had neighbors, that some of the family friends and old homes had survived, drove out the terrible loss and alone feeling which had oppressed her in her first weeks at Tara. And the Fontaines and Tarletons, whose plantations had not been in the path of the army, were most generous in sharing what little they had. It was the tradition of the county that neighbor helped neighbor, and they refused to accept a penny from Scarlet, telling her that she would do the same for them, and she could pay them back in kind next year when Tara was again producing. Scarlet now had food for her household. She had a horse. She had the money and jewelry taken from the Yankee straggler, and the greatest need was new clothing. She knew it would be risky business sending Pork south to buy clothes, when the horse might be captured by either Yankees or Confederates. But at least she had the money with which to buy the clothes, a horse and wagon for the trip, and perhaps Pork could make the trip without getting caught. Yes, the worst was over. Every morning when Scarlet arose, she thanked God for the pale blue sky and the warm sun. For each day of good weather put off the inevitable time when warm clothing would be needed. And each warm day saw more and more cotton piling up in the empty slave quarters, the only storage place left on the plantation. There was more cotton in the fields than she or Pork had estimated, probably 4 bales. And soon the cabins would be full. Scarlet hadn't intended to do any cotton picking herself, even after Grandma Fontaine's tart remark. It was unthinkable that she, an O'Hara lady, now the mistress of Tara, should work in the fields. It put her on the same level with the snarly-haired Mrs. Slattery and Emmy. She had intended that the Negroes should do the field work while she and the convalescent girls attended to the house. But here she was confronted with a caste feeling even stronger than her own. Pork, Mammy, and Prissy set up outcries at the idea of working in the fields. They reiterated that they were house niggers, not field hands. Mammy, in particular, declared vehemently that she had never even been a yard nigger. She had been born in the Robillard great house, not in the quarters, and had been raised in old Miz's bedroom, sleeping on a pallet at the foot of a bed. Dilsey alone said nothing, and she fixed her Prissy with an unwinking eye that made her squirm. Scarlet refused to listen to the protests and drove them all into the cotton rows. But Mammy and Pork worked so slowly and with so many lamentations that Scarlet sent Mammy back to the kitchen to cook and Pork to the woods and the river with snares for rabbits and possums and lines for fish. Cotton picking was beneath Pork's dignity, but hunting and fishing were not. Scarlet next had tried her sisters and Melanie in the fields, but that had worked no better. Melanie had picked neatly, quickly, and willingly for an hour in the hot sun, and then fainted quietly, and had to stay in bed for a week. Sue Ellen, sullen and tearful, pretended to faint, too, but came back to consciousness, spitting like an angry cat, when Scarlet poured a gourdful of water in her face. Finally, she refused, point-blank. "I won't work in the fields like a darky. You can't make me. What if any of our friends ever heard of it? What if Mr. Kennedy ever knew? Oh, if Mother knew about this! You just mention Mother's name once more, Sue Ellen O'Hara, and I'll slap you flat!" cried Scarlet. "Mother worked harder than any darky on this place, and you know it, Miss Fine Ayers. She did not. At least not in the fields. And you can't make me. I'll tell Papa on you, and he won't make me work. Don't you dare go bothering Pa with any of our troubles," cried Scarlet, distracted between indignation at her sister and fear for Gerald. "I'll help you, Sissy," interposed Corrine, docilely. "I'll work for Sue and me, too. She isn't well yet, and she shouldn't be out in the sun." Scarlet said gratefully, "Thank you, Sugar Baby," but looked worriedly at her younger sister. Corrine, who had always been as delicately pink and white as the orchard blossoms that are scattered by the spring wind, was no longer pink, but still conveyed in her sweet, thoughtful face a blossom-like quality. She had been silent, a little dazed, since she came back to consciousness and found Ellen gone. Scarlet, a termagant. The world changed, and unceasing labor the order of the new day. It was not in Corrine's delicate nature to adjust herself to change. She simply couldn't comprehend what had happened, and she went about Tara like a sleepwalker, doing exactly what she was told. She looked and was frail, but she was willing, obedient, and obliging. when she was not doing Scarlet's bidding. Her rosary beads were always in her hands, and her lips moving in prayers for her mother and for Brent Tarleton. It did not occur to Scarlet that Corrine had taken Brent's death so seriously, and that her grief was unhealed. To Scarlet, Corrine was still baby sister, far too young to have had a really serious love affair. Scarlet, standing in the sun in the cotton rows, her back breaking from the eternal bending, and her hands roughened by the dry bowls, wished she had a sister who combined Sue Ellen's energy and strength with Corrine's sweet disposition. For Corrine picked diligently and earnestly. But after she had labored for an hour, it was obvious that she, and not Sue Ellen, was the one not yet well enough for such work. So Scarlet sent Corrine back to the house, too. There remained with her now in the long rows only Dilsey and Prissy. Prissy picked lazily, spasmodically, complaining of her feet, her back, her internal miseries, her complete weariness, until her mother took a cotton stalk to her and whipped her until she screamed. After that she worked a little better, taking care to stay far away from her mother's reach. Dilsey worked tirelessly, silently, like a machine. And Scarlet, with her back aching and her shoulder raw from the tugging weight of the cotton bag she carried, thought that Dilsey was worth her weight in gold. "Dilsey," she said, "when good times come back, I'm not going to forget how you've acted. You've been mighty good." The bronze giantess did not grin pleasedly, or squirm under praise like other Negroes. She turned an immobile face to Scarlet and said with dignity, "Thank you, ma'am. But Mr. Gerald and Miss Ellen been good to me. Mr. Gerald buy my Prissy so I wouldn't grieve, and I don't forget it. As part Indian, and Indians don't forget them as is good to them. I sigh about my Prissy. She mighty worthless. Look like she all nigger like a paw. Her paw was mighty flighty." In spite of Scarlet's problem of getting help from others in the picking, and in spite of the weariness of doing the labor herself, her spirits lifted as the cotton slowly made its way from the fields to the cabins. There was something about cotton that was reassuring, steadying. Tara had risen to riches on cotton, even as the whole South had risen. And Scarlet was Southerner enough to believe that both Tara and the South would rise again out of the red fields. Of course, this little cotton she had gathered was not much, but it was something. It would bring a little in Confederate money, and that little would help her to save the hoarded greenbacks and gold in the Yankees' wallet until they had to be spent. Next spring, she would try to make the Confederate government send back Big Sam and the other field hands they had commandeered. And if the government wouldn't release them, she'd use the Yankees' money to hire field hands from the neighbors. Next spring she would plant and plant. She straightened her tired back, and looking over the browning autumn fields, she saw next year's crop standing sturdy and green, acre upon acre. Next spring! Perhaps by next spring the war would be over and good times would be back. And whether the Confederacy won or lost, times would be better. Anything was better than the constant danger of raids from both armies. When the war was over, a plantation could earn an honest living. Oh, if the war were only over! Then people could plant crops with some certainty of reaping them. There was hope now. The war couldn't last forever. She had her little cotton. She had food. She had a horse. She had her small but treasured hoard of money. Yes. The worst was over. Chapter 27. On a noon day, in mid-November, they all sat grouped about the dinner table, eating the last of the dessert concocted by Mammy from cornmeal and dried huckleberries, sweetened with sorghum. There was a chill in the air. The first chill of the year. And Pork, standing behind Scarlet's chair, rubbed his hands together in glee and questioned, "Ain't it about time for the hog killing, Miss Scarlet?"
"You can taste those chitlins already, can't you?" said Scarlet with a grin.
"Well, I can taste fresh pork myself. And if the weather holds for a few days more, we'll..."
Melanie interrupted, her spoon at her lips.
"Listen, dear. Somebody's coming."
"Somebody hollering," said Pork uneasily.
On the crisp autumn air came clear the sound of horses' hooves, thudding as swiftly as a frightened hart, and a woman's voice, high-pitched, screaming, "Scarlet! Scarlet!" I met eye for a dreadful second around the table before chairs were pushed back and everybody leaped up. Despite the fear that made it shrill, they recognized the voice of Sally Fontaine, who, only an hour before, had stopped at Terra for a brief chat on her way to Jonesboro. Now, as they all rushed pell-mell to crowd the front door, they saw her coming up the drive like the wind on a lathered horse, her hair streaming behind her, her bonnet dangling by its ribbons. She didn't draw rein, but as she galloped madly toward them, she waved her arm back in that direction from which she had come. "The Yankees are coming! I saw them! Down the road! The Yankees!" She sawed savagely at the horse's mouth just in time to swerve him from leaping up the front steps. He swung around sharply, covered the side lawn in three leaps, and she put him across the 4-foot hedge as if she were on the hunting field. They heard the heavy pounding of his hooves as he went through the backyard and down the narrow lane between the cabins of the quarters, and knew she was cutting across the fields to Mimosa. For a moment they stood paralyzed, and then Sue Ellen and Corrine began to sob and clutch each other's fingers. Little Wade stood rooted, trembling, unable to cry. What he had feared since the night he left Atlanta had happened. The Yankees were coming to get him.
"Yankees?" said Gerald vaguely. "But the Yankees have already been here."
"Mother of God!" cried Scarlet, her eyes meeting Melanie's frightened eyes. For a swift instant, there went through her memory again the horrors of her last night in Atlanta, the ruined homes that dotted the countryside, all the stories of rape and torture and murder. She saw again the Yankee soldier standing in the hall with Ellen's sewing box in his hand. She thought, "I shall die. I shall die right here. I thought we were through with all that. I shall die. I can't stand any more." Then her eyes fell on the horse saddled and hitched and waiting for Pork to ride him to the Tarleton place on an errand. Her horse! Her only horse! The Yankees would take him and the cow and the calf and the sow and her litter. Oh, how many tiring hours it had taken to catch that sow and her agile young. And they'd take the rooster and the setting hens and the ducks the Fontaines had given her, and the apples and the yams in the pantry bins, and the flour and rice and dried peas, and the money in the Yankee soldier's wallet. They'd take everything and leave them to starve. "They shan't have them," she cried aloud. And they all turned startled faces to her, fearful her mind had cracked under the tidings. "I won't go hungry. They shan't have them."
"What is it, Scarlet? What is it?"
"The horse, the cow, the pigs. They shan't have them. I won't let them have them." She turned swiftly to the four Negroes who huddled in the doorway, their black faces a peculiarly ashen shade. "The swamp," she said rapidly.
"What swamp?"
"The river swamp, you fools. Take the pigs to the swamp, all of you, quickly. Pork, you and Prissy crawl under the house and get the pigs out. Sue Ellen, you and Corrine fill the baskets with as much food as you can carry and get to the woods. Mammy, put the silver in the well again. And Pork, listen to me. Don't stand there like that. Take Pa with you. Don't ask me where. Anywhere. Go with Pa. That's a sweet Pa. Even in her frenzy, she thought what the sight of Bluecoats might do to Gerald's wavering mind. She stopped and wrung her hands in the frightened sobbing of little Wade, who was clutching Melanie's skirt, added to her panic. "What shall I do, Scarlet?" Melanie's voice was calm amid the wailing and tears and scurrying feet, though her face was paper white and her whole body trembled. The very quietness of her voice steadied Scarlet, revealing to her that they all looked to her for commands, for guidance. "The cow and the calf," she said quickly. "They're in the old pasture. Take the horse and drive them into the swamp and..." Before she could finish her sentence, Melanie shook off Wade's clutches and was down the front steps and running toward the horse, pulling up her wide skirts as she ran. Scarlet caught a flashing glimpse of thin legs, a flurry of skirts and underclothing, and Melanie was in the saddle, her feet dangling far above the stirrups. She gathered up the reins and clapped her heels against the animal's sides, and then abruptly pulled him in, her face twisting with horror. "My baby," she cried. "Oh, my baby! The Yankees will kill him! Give him to me!" Her hand was on the pommel, and she was preparing to slide off, but Scarlet screamed at her. "Go on! Go on! Get the cow! I'll look after the baby! Go on! I tell you! Do you think I'd let them get Ashley's baby? Go on!" Melly looked despairingly backward, but hammered her heels into the horse, and with a scattering of gravel, was off down the drive toward the pasture. Scarlet thought, "I never expected to see Melly Hamilton straddling a horse." And then she ran into the house. Wade was at her heels sobbing, trying to catch her flying skirts. As she went up the steps, three at a bound, she saw Sue Ellen and Corrine with split oak baskets on their arms, running toward the pantry, and Pork tugging none too gently at Gerald's arm, dragging him toward the back porch. Gerald was mumbling querulously and pulling away like a child. From the backyard she heard Mammy's strident voice. "You Pris! You get under that house and hand me them shoats. You know mighty well I's too big to crawl through them lattices. Dilsey, come here and make this worthless child." "And I thought it was such a good idea to keep the pigs under the house so nobody could steal them," thought Scarlet, running into her room. "Why, oh, why didn't I build a pen for them down in the swamp?" She tore open her top bureau drawer and scratched about in the clothing until the Yankee's wallet was in her hand. Hastily, she picked up the solitaire ring and the diamond earbobs from where she had hidden them in her sewing basket and shoved them into the wallet. But where to hide it? In the mattress? Up the chimney? Throw it in the well? Put it in her bosom? No, never there. The outlines of the wallet might show through her basque, and if the Yankees saw it, they would strip her naked and search her. "I shall die if they do," she thought wildly. Downstairs, there was a pandemonium of racing feet and sobbing voices. Even in her frenzy, Scarlet wished she had Melanie with her. Melly, with her quiet voice. Melly, who was so brave the day she shot the Yankee. Melly was worth three of the others. Melly. What had Melly said? Oh, yes, the baby. Clutching the wallet to her, Scarlet ran across the hall to the room where little Beau was sleeping in the low cradle. She snatched him up into her arms and he awoke, waving small fists and slobbering sleepily. She heard Sue Ellen crying, "Come on, Corrine, come on! We've got enough! Oh, sister, hurry!" There were wild squealings, indignant gruntings in the backyard, and running to the window, Scarlet saw Mammy waddling hurriedly across the cotton field with a struggling young pig under each arm. Behind her was Pork, also carrying two pigs, and pushing Gerald before him. Gerald was stumping across the furrows, waving his cane. Leaning out of the window, Scarlet yelled, "Get the sow, Dilsey! Make Prissy drive her out! You can chase her across the fields!" Dilsey looked up, her bronzed face harassed. In her apron was a pile of silver tableware.
She pointed under the house.
The sow done bit Prissy and got her pinned up under the house.
Good for the sow, thought Scarlet.
She hurried back into her room and hastily gathered from her hiding place the bracelets, brooch, miniature, and cup she had found on the dead Yankee. But where to hide them? It was awkward, carrying little Beau in one arm and the wallet and the trinkets in the other. She started to lay him on the bed. He set up a wail at leaving her arms, and a welcome thought came to her. What better hiding place could there be than a baby's diaper? She quickly turned him over, pulled up his dress, and thrust the wallet down the diaper next to his backside. He yelled louder at this treatment, and she hastily tightened the triangular garment about his threshing legs. Now, she thought, drawing a deep breath. Now for the swamp. Tucking him screaming under one arm and clutching the jewelry to her with the other, she raced into the upstairs hall. Suddenly, her rapid steps paused, fright weakening her knees. How silent the house was. How dreadfully still. Had they all gone off and left her? Hadn't anyone waited for her? She hadn't meant for them to leave her here alone. These days anything could happen to a lone woman, and with the Yankees coming. She jumped as a slight noise sounded, and turning quickly, saw crouched by the banisters her forgotten son, his eyes enormous with terror. He tried to speak, but his throat only worked silently. "Get up, Wade Hampton," she commanded swiftly. "Get up and walk. Mother can't carry you now." He ran to her, like a small frightened animal, and clutching her wide skirt, buried his face in it. She could feel his small hands groping through the folds for her legs. She started down the stairs, each step hampered by Wade's dragging hands, and she said fiercely, "Turn me loose, Wade! Turn me loose and walk!" But the child only clung the closer. As she reached the landing, the whole lower floor leaped up at her. All the homely, well-loved articles of furniture seemed to whisper, "Goodbye. Goodbye." A sob rose in her throat. There was the open door of the office where Ellen had labored so diligently, and she could glimpse a corner of the old secretary. There was the dining room, with chairs pushed awry and food still on the plates. There on the floor were the rag rugs Ellen had dyed and woven herself. And there was the old portrait of Grandma Robillard, with bosoms half bared, hair piled high and nostrils cut so deeply as to give her face a perpetual well-bred sneer. Everything which had been part of her earliest memories, everything bound up with the deepest roots in her. Goodbye. Goodbye, Scarlet O'Hara. The Yankees would burn it all. All. This was her last view of home. Her last view except what she might see from the cover of the woods or the swamp. The tall chimneys wrapped in smoke, the roof crashing in flame. "I can't leave you," she thought, and her teeth chattered with fear. "I can't leave you. Pa wouldn't leave you. He told them they'd have to burn you over his head. Then they'll burn you over my head, for I can't leave you either. You're all I've got left." With a decision, some of her fear fell away, and there remained only a congealed feeling in her breast, as if all hope and fear had frozen. As she stood there, she heard from the avenue the sound of many horses' feet, the jingle of bridle bits and sabers rattling in scabbards, and a harsh voice crying a command, "Dismount!" Swiftly, she bent to the child beside her, and her voice was urgent but oddly gentle. "Turn me loose, Wade, honey. You run down the stairs quick, and through the backyard toward the swamp. Mammy will be there, and Aunt Millie. Run quickly, darling. And don't be afraid." At the change in her tone, the boy looked up and Scarlet was appalled at the look in his eyes, like a baby rabbit in a trap. "Oh, Mother of God," she prayed, "don't let him have a convulsion. Not before the Yankees. They mustn't know we are afraid." And as the child only gripped her skirt the tighter, she said clearly, "Be a little man, Wade. They're only a passel of damn Yankees." And she went down the steps to meet them.
Sherman was marching through Georgia, from Atlanta to the sea. Behind him lay the smoking ruins of Atlanta to which the torch had been set as the Blue Army tramped out. Before him lay 300 miles of territory, virtually undefended, save by a few state militia and the old men and young boys of the Home Guard. Here lay the fertile state, dotted with plantations, sheltering the women and children, the very old and the Negroes. In a swath 80 miles wide, the Yankees were looting and burning. There were hundreds of homes in flames, hundreds of homes resounding with their footsteps. But to Scarlet, watching the bluecoats pour into the front hall, it was not a countrywide affair. It was entirely personal, a malicious action aimed directly at her and hers. She stood at the foot of the stairs, the baby in her arms. Wade pressed tightly against her, his head hidden in her skirts as the Yankees swarmed through the house, pushing roughly past her up the stairs, dragging furniture onto the front porch, running bayonets and knives into upholstery, and digging inside for concealed valuables. Upstairs they were ripping open mattresses and feather beds until the air in the hall was thick with feathers that floated softly down on her head. Impotent rage quelled what little fear was left in her heart as she stood helpless while they plundered and stole and ruined. The sergeant in charge was a bow-legged, grizzled little man with a large wad of tobacco in his cheek. He reached Scarlet before any of his men and, spitting freely on the floor and her skirts, said briefly, "Let me have what you got in your hand, lady." She had forgotten the trinket she had intended to hide, and with a sneer which she hoped was as eloquent as that pictured on Grandma Robillard's face, she flung the articles to the floor and almost enjoyed the rapacious scramble that ensued. "I'll trouble you for that ring and them earbobs." Scarlet tucked the baby more securely under her arm so that he hung face downward, crimson and screaming, and removed the garnet earrings which had been Gerald's wedding present to Ellen. Then she stripped off the large sapphire solitaire which Charles had given her as an engagement ring. "Don't throw 'em. Hand 'em to me," said the sergeant, putting out his hands. "Them bastards got enough already. What else have you got?" His eyes went over her basque sharply. For a moment Scarlet went faint, already feeling rough hands thrusting themselves into her bosom, fumbling at her garters. "That's all. But I suppose it's customary to strip your victims." "Oh, I'll take your word," said the sergeant good-naturedly, spitting again as he turned away. Scarlet righted the baby and tried to soothe him, holding her hand over the place on the diaper where the wallet was hidden, thanking God that Melanie had a baby, and that baby had a diaper. Upstairs she could hear heavy boots trampling, the protesting screech of furniture pulled across the floor, the crashing of china and mirrors, the curses when nothing of value appeared. From the yard came loud cries. "Head 'em off! Don't let 'em get away!" And the despairing squawks of the hens and quacking and honking of the ducks and geese. A pang went through her as she heard an agonized squealing, which was suddenly stilled by a pistol shot, and she knew that the sow was dead. Damn Prissy! She had run off and left her. If only the shoats were safe. If only the family had gotten safely to the swamp. But there was no way of knowing. She stood quietly in the hall while the soldiers boiled about her, shouting and cursing, Wade's fingers were in her skirt in a terrified grip. She could feel his body shaking as he pressed against her, but she couldn't bring herself to speak reassuringly to him. She couldn't bring herself to utter any word to the Yankees, either of pleading, protest, or anger. She could only thank God that her knees still had the strength to support her, that her neck was still strong enough to hold her head high. But when a squad of bearded men came lumbering down the steps, laden with an assortment of stolen articles, and she saw Charles's sword in the hands of one, she did cry out. That sword was Wade's. It had been his father's and his grandfather's sword, and Scarlet had given it to the little boy on his last birthday. They had made quite a ceremony of it, and Melanie had cried with tears of pride and sorrowful memory, and kissed him, and said he must grow up to be a brave soldier like his father and his grandfather. Wade was very proud of it, and often climbed upon the table beneath where it hung to pat it. Scarlet could endure seeing her own possessions going out of the house in hateful alien hands, but not this. Not her little boy's pride. Wade, peering from the protection of her skirts, at the sound of her cry, found speech and courage in a mighty sob. Stretching out one hand, he cried, "Mine!" "You can't take that," said Scarlet swiftly, holding out her hand too.
"I can't, hey," said the little soldier who held it, grinning impudently at her. "Well, I can. It's a rebel sword."
It's not. It's a Mexican war sword. You can't take it. It's my little boy's. It was his grandfather's. Oh, Captain," she cried, turning to the sergeant, "please make him give it to me." The sergeant, pleased at his promotion, stepped forward.
"Let me see that sword, bub," he said. Reluctantly, the little trooper handed it to him.
"It's got a solid gold hilt," he said. The sergeant turned it in his hand, held the hilt up to the sunlight to read the engraved inscription.
"To Colonel William R. Hamilton," he deciphered, "from his staff, for gallantry. Buena Vista, 1847.
"Ho, lady," he said. "I was at Buena Vista myself."
"Indeed," said Scarlet icily.
"Was I? That was hot fighting, let me tell you. I ain't seen such hot fighting in this war as we seen in that one. So this sword was this little tyke's granddaddy's?"
"Yes."
"Well, he can have it," said the sergeant,
who was satisfied enough with the jewelry and trinkets tied up in his handkerchief.
"But it's got a solid gold hilt," insisted the little trooper.
"We'll leave her that to remember us by," grinned the sergeant.
Scarlet took the sword, not even saying thank you. Why should she thank these thieves for returning her own property to her? She held the sword against her while the little cavalryman argued and wrangled with the sergeant.
"By God, I'll give these damn rebels something to remember me by," shouted the private finally when the sergeant, losing his good nature, told him to go to hell and not talk back. The little man went charging toward the back of the house, and Scarlet breathed more easily. They had said nothing about burning the house. They hadn't told her to leave so they could fire it. Perhaps... The men came rambling into the hall from the upstairs and the out-of-doors. "Anything?" questioned the sergeant. "One hog and a few chickens and ducks. Some corn and a few yams and beans. The wildcat we saw on the horse must have given the alarm all right. Regular Paul Revere, eh? Well, there ain't much here, Sarge. You got the pickings. Let's move on before the whole country gets the news we're coming. Did you dig under the smokehouse? They generally bury things there. Ain't no smokehouse. Did you dig in the nigger cabins? Nothing but cotton in the cabins. We set fire to it."
For a brief instant, Scarlet saw the long, hot days in the cotton field, felt again the terrible ache in her back, the raw, bruised flesh of her shoulders. All for nothing. The cotton was gone.
"You ain't got much for a fact, have you, lady?"
Your army has been here before, she said coolly.
That's a fact. We were in this neighborhood in September, said one of the men, turning something in his hand.